Okay. So I guess we can probably start the with the suttas. And as I was saying yesterday, the theme of the retreat is going to be on dependent origination. That's the kind of the main outline. But many of the suttas will be the same as I teach on all retreats, because they are basic to the understanding of meditation and basic to the understanding of the whole path of Buddhist practice. So today, or this morning rather, I'm going to just start off with a few basic things, the kind of things which are not directly related to dependent origination as such. Actually, they are related in a way, because everything in Buddhism is related to everything else. It's like this, all these cross connections everywhere, and everything has some connection to everything else. But it's not directly related. But these are kind of important, basic things that is always very useful to remember, in particular on a meditation retreat. So these are kind of fundamental things that are good to keep in mind. And the first sutta today is called volition. Volition means will, the willpower inside. This is one of these suttas that is very useful to always reflect on when it comes to meditation practice. One of those very important suttas in the Buddhist teachings. Sometimes you may wonder, how do we decide whether a particular sutta is important or not? How can you know that? And the way you can know that is that there are certain themes, certain things that are spoken of again and again by the Buddha in different situations, different places, to different audiences. And those things that are spoken of again and again, you can be quite sure that that must be something of importance, otherwise the Buddha wouldn't emphasize these things so much. And this particular sutta, this particular structure that you see here, this particular sequence of conditions, one thing leading to the next one, is one of those things that are one of those basic themes you find in the suttas. What is interesting about this sutta as well is that it also exists in other ancient languages. This sutta also exists in ancient Chinese in translation. It was translated about 1,600 years ago or thereabouts into Chinese. And when you read that sutta today, I can't read Chinese, unfortunately. I wish I could, because it would be really, really good to be able to read the suttas in Chinese as well. But they are now translated into English as well, from the Chinese. And when you read this particular sutta in that translation, it is word for word pretty much exactly the same as the Pali. That is quite astonishing when you think about how ancient these things are, how long they have been separated from each other. The lineage which the Chinese comes from compared to the Pali, these lineages have been separated for about 2,300 years or thereabouts. It's only about 150 years after the Buddha's time they started to separate. And still, you read them today, they are virtually word for word exactly the same. So you feel that here you are really in the presence of the Buddha, right? This is it. This is the Buddha's teachings. So it's enough to kind of give you goosebumps when you hear this. You know the Buddha is talking to you, right? So this is kind of the point with this. Very exciting, right? The Buddha is in your presence when you hear these things. Imagine meeting the Buddha. Well, now you're going to meet the Buddha. So this is what it feels like to meet the Buddha. Well, not exactly, because of course the Buddha has a certain presence as well, but you get some idea what it's like to meet the Buddha when you hear these teachings. Okay, so I'm going to read this out first of all, and then comment on it afterwards. Here we go. Bhikkhus, monks in other words, or nuns, right, bhikkhunis, or lay people, everyone is included. The reason why it starts with bhikkhus is because the bhikkhus are like the main audience, usually. Bhikkhus, for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no will need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. For For one without regret, no will need be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no will need be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no will need be exerted. Let my body become tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no will need be exerted. Let me feel pleasure or happiness. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels happiness. For one feeling happiness, no will need be exerted. Let my mind be stilled. It is natural that the mind of one feeling happiness is stilled. For one who is stilled, no will need be exerted. Let me know and see things as they really are. It is natural that one who is stilled knows and sees things as they really are. Okay, so there you are. So that is the Buddha. That's the sort of thing that he would say here. Now, the first thing about this, right, the first thing that you think when you, well, at least I think when I see this, is I think, wow, so repetitious, so kind of boring almost, right? One thing after the other, exactly the same. And some people think, oh, this is really boring, I can't keep reading this kind of thing here. This is just terrible. But the point is, remember, the point here is that repetition, what it means is that it lends emphasis to certain words. Those words that are not repeated in here are obviously the important ones. They are the ones that show you the process or the progress of the samadhi or the stilling of the mind in this particular case. So it allows you to focus on certain things, and those things are the most important ones. So you see through this whole sequence that there's one word which changes all the way through, and that is the principle and the crucial word. You go from virtue to non-regret, from non-regret to joy, from joy to rapture, from rapture to tranquility, tranquility to happiness to stillness, stillness to seeing things according to reality. And then you can see this is the sequence that this is focusing on, right? It makes it enables you to focus on those things that really matter. So this is one of the great things about this. It's not boring at all. It just helps you. If you look at it in the right way, it may seem boring, but if you think about it in the right way, actually it is very meaningful and very powerful. So this is the first thing about this, to remember this is not really boring. And one of the points here, and one of the things that I want to show you as well, even each of those paragraphs that is repeated actually is full of meaning. Almost every word there has some relevance to it. One of the things about the Buddha's teachings is that he was very skilled at saying things in very precise and very good ways. You know, the way he describes deep samadhi, for example, most of us, when you get into a state of samadhi or into a meditation experience, which is unusual, which you have never had before, which is outside of our ordinary experience, you think, oh, I can't explain this. This is just way beyond what is explicable. And yet somehow the Buddha is able to explain even these most profound things in a way which actually is very meaningful and very beautiful. This is one of the great things about the Buddha. This is one of the things that makes him special, his ability to actually pronounce these teachings in a way which is very very accurate, precise, meaningful. Everything actually matters. So the purpose of this particular sutta is to show you how meditation is experienced personally, right? How is the process experienced by you, inside of you, as you go through the process? This is the purpose of this. Some people have called this the psychology of meditation. Another word that is used to describe this sequence is dependent liberation, because it shows you the liberation in mind stage by stage, right? But it is the internal experience, how we actually experience this path when it is working in the right way. So for that reason, it's very useful, because what it then does, it gives you all these signposts, right? This signpost saying so and so far to Nibbana, right? Oh, getting closer to Nibbana, now it's only so and so far left. It gives you this feeling that you're heading, whether you're heading in the right direction or not. It's like these signs, right? 50 kilometers to Perth, 40 kilometers to Perth, right? And it's almost like a similar kind of thing. These are the signposts on the way that show you whether your meditation is working or not. And there is at least, there's a couple of ways in which to understand this. One thing is to understand this in the context of a single meditation session, right? You sit down, how is your meditation going? Are you going through this sequence in your meditation session, or are you not? This is one way to actually use this. And then you don't actually think about these factors as you meditate. It's more like you just have them at the back of your mind. They're kind of there. And you sort of know automatically that you're heading in the right direction because these things are happening here. So that is in the context of a single sitting of meditation, but it's also in the broader context, right? In your life more generally. Every year when you come back to Jhana Grove to do a retreat, or you go somewhere else to do a retreat or whatever it is, you have a way of assessing your meditation progress. Are you going somewhere? Is it becoming more profound? Are you experiencing more of these factors that you did last time? So it is a twofold thing within each session, but also more broadly about whether you are improving, going in the right direction on the Buddhist path. So for this reason, very useful. Again, it's not about memorizing these things so much, but just to get a general idea about what is going on here. And one of the things, of course, that stand out about this when you read this, and that is the emphasis, the very powerful emphasis on these positive states of mind, right? It kind of starts off with non-regret. Okay, it doesn't sound so great, but it's obviously nice as well. But then from then on, you have joy, you have rapture, you have tranquility, you have happiness. It says pleasure here. I'm not sure if pleasure is, anyway, whatever. Happiness, right? You have the stillness of the mind, the samadhi, here translated as concentration, and eventually seeing things in accordance with the reality. This enormous emphasis on happy states of mind. And that gives you some idea about what Buddhism is all about, this emphasis on happiness. It kind of makes sense, right? You know already from the Four Noble Truths, the focus on suffering, this is suffering, dukkha, and all this kind of things. So we know that this path really, of course, is about happiness. But it only really gets driven home to you when you start to see here the psychology. It's all about the personal experience of happiness in one way or another. From the little happinesses to the medium happiness to the really, really profound, deep states of happiness, all of that is part of this path. And this is what is so wonderful about these teachings, right? And this is the danger, perhaps, of always talking about Buddhism as the teaching about suffering. The danger is that, you know, people say, oh, Buddhism is so pessimistic, right? It's so negative. Life is wonderful. There's all this happiness to be had in life. The problem is that the idea when we talk about suffering is often a very profound understanding. And it's impossible for most of us to really understand what the Buddha means by that simple truth of suffering. So for that reason, it's important to remember that actually the Buddhist teaching really, there's another side to this coin, the reverse side of the coin of suffering, and that is the side of happiness instead. It's such an extraordinary positive message, right? Here you can read about all of these things that are awaiting you on the path if you practice in the right way. This is what's going to happen. This is where you're heading. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that astonishing? It's like when you read this, you think, whoa, wow, I want to be part of this. Why should I not be part of this? This is what it's all about, right? This is what life is all about. Moving towards more satisfaction, more contentment, more happiness, less problems, less suffering in life. So this is, I think, one of those powerful messages that come out in this particular sutta. So keep that in mind, because again, it shows you, it gives you some idea of whether you are practicing in the right way or not. Of course, one of the important points here as well is that if you force yourself too much in your meditation practice, if you feel a lot of pain or you feel a lot of tension, you're not really relaxed, you're not really at ease, there is no way that you're going to access this kind of happiness if you do that. We have to start off with the ease, right? We have to start off with the relaxation. We have to start off with just sitting here and enjoying the sitting here. And then the happiness comes along as a consequence. If you start off with too much pain, then you know that already you're heading in the wrong direction. You're not going to be able to experience these kinds of state of mind. So for that reason too, it is quite it shows you what you're supposed to be doing here. So that is a couple of things here that comes out straight away. The other thing which is very interesting about this sutta is that you will see that every refrain, every time you go from one factor to the other one, it has this refrain: no volition need be exerted. Na chetanaya karaniya. Karaniya, to be done, na chetanaya, not by will is it to be done. This is not to be done by will or willpower. So every aspect here, from the first one to the last one, as you move from one factor to the other one, from one stage of the meditation to the next, they're not really stages, right? It's just a kind of fluidity, really. You're moving along, but we need words to talk about this. But as you are moving along, there is no effort. This cannot be done by effort, right? It is natural, it says here. The word for natural, dhammata, is related to the word dhamma. The word dhamma in Buddhism has a very broad range of meanings. But one of the basic meanings of dhamma, it means that it is according to nature, according to the laws of nature. That's why it says here natural. This is the way things have to happen. This is a natural process. It's like the laws of physics, right? The laws of physics, the universe functions in a certain way. Well, these are the laws of the mind. The mind functions in this way. If you just allow it to happen stage by stage, it is a dhammata. It has to happen according to the laws of nature. This is what this means. So there is no, this cannot be done by the will. It happens according to nature. Right? Isn't that great? What that means is that there's nothing for you to do. All you have to do is just sit back and wait. Right? And if you put the will in there, because it isn't to be done by willpower, it means that the more will you enter into all of these factors, you enter into your meditation practice, the more you try to achieve these things, the more effort you put into it, the more you're going to get in the way. Right? It cannot be done by will. It has to happen in accordance with the laws of nature. So it means that you just have to sit back. You just have to wait. You have to allow these things to arise all by themselves. Isn't that wonderful? There's nothing you have to do except for just relax, right? Chill out. Enjoy yourself. Just sit back. It's such a wonderful, again, message, this idea that there's nothing that we need to do, nothing that we have to kind of strive for or anything like that. And this is the way, of course, people like Ajahn Brahm, he always teaches meditation like that, you know. And people get really frustrated to hear Ajahn Brahm's meditation. And I used to get quite frustrated myself. But you must do something, right? I can't just sit there. I just fall asleep. You know, how can you do this? It doesn't work. What's happening? This is how people feel when they get this very simple instruction. Just be, right? No human doing, just human being. Just sit back and relax. So this is, in a sense, the hard part, this ability to actually do that, to really be able to just enjoy the present moment, to be here, not to do anything, and allow these things to arise according to nature. This is kind of the hard part here. And one of the reasons why it is hard is because the foundation factors for these things to arise, they are not strong enough yet. Right, this is one of the reasons why it is so hard. So of course, when you have a sequence like this, a natural sequence, one thing leading to the next one, as a matter of course, right? All you have to do is to sit back and wait and allow things to arise. Well, the reason why it doesn't work, if it is a natural sequence, is of course because of the first factor, right? The first factor, if that isn't right, then of course the whole sequence itself doesn't really get started. So the important point here, the most important of all these factors to get right, is the first one. This is the factor of sila. It is here translated as virtue, which is not really, it's not the ideal translation. It's very hard to find a good translation for the word sila, actually. But this is the most important one, because if you get the sila, if you get the virtue right, then that is when everything else happens as a matter of course. If the sila isn't strong enough, if the sila is only partially developed, not fully developed, then, of course, the sequence isn't going to take off in the way it's supposed to do. Right? So this is also very, very important then. So it means that we start to focus on the right areas in our life. All your life, you can look at your life outside of meditation. Once you come to meditation, all you have to do is sit back and wait, right, and relax and enjoy yourself. But outside of meditation, that is where all these developments of virtue, of sila, actually come into play, where they are important, right? So you can, in one way, you can look upon your whole life as a support for your meditation practice. And if your whole life becomes something where you emphasize this idea of sila, right? You're kind of preparing, using your entire life just to prepare yourself for the meditation practice. It is when you come to the meditation, when you come here to Jhana Grove, or you come on a retreat or whatever, and you sit down and you actually start to access these things, that is when you come the closest to the meaning of life. This is where we are approaching what life is all about. At least ideally, if your meditation is working. Sometimes it doesn't work, but at least you have tried. So the rest of your life then is about helping you to make life more meaningful when you come on these retreats, to enable you to access these things, which actually gives life a very deep sense of meaning. So that's what sila is about, right? So sila, this very broad term, which of course encompasses all the aspects of morality, right action, right speech, right? Of course it is part of that. But sila, in a sense, the virtue, means much more than that. It means not just avoiding the bad things, it means also doing the good things. And this is one of the reasons why we have its emphasis on generosity, for example, on the Buddhist path. Generosity is the opposite of stealing, right? Which is one of the wrong actions. This is why we have the emphasis on compassion. Compassion is the opposite of killing or of being ruthless or harmful to living beings. Right? So sila is about behavior in a very broad sense. And we move towards the positive behavior, go away from the bad ones. And of course, sila is also, and this is where it becomes very refined and more difficult to practice, it is also about the mental behavior itself. So we have to learn how to shift our mental attitudes, to look at life in a different way, to look at people in a different way. And as you do that, as you shift your attitudes, you're developing the mind itself directly. And of course, now you can start to see why sila becomes such a powerful foundation for practicing meditation, because you have, once you come to the meditation practice, your attitude is right? You already have the compassion there. The generosity is already in your heart. The right speech is there. All of these good qualities are already present. And then when you sit down, it sort of happens automatically by itself. So I will be talking more about sila, this idea of right habit or right life, if you like, later on, because it is such an important thing. And of course, it is also part of meditation practice itself, the way of developing the mind and these wholesome qualities. So that is that becomes then very important, right? The first stage, when you have a sequence of natural things, one thing leading to another one, the first one is obviously the most important one, and the rest is then automatic. Also, very important in this whole scheme of things is also the last one that I have mentioned here. I haven't actually taken it all the way to the end, because we have plenty enough to work with right here. It goes all the way to the end, to final liberation or awakening, the sequence. but I thought this is probably enough for most of us. The last one here is also very interesting because it shows us, of course, what is the purpose of all this. And the purpose of all this, it says here, let me know and see things as they really are. Or let me know and see things according to reality, is the last one, right? And this is what we are aiming for. This is the purpose of Buddhism, in a sense, to get insight, to get wisdom, to see things in accordance with reality. And of course, what is powerful here is this idea that it is stillness. It is samadhi, it is concentration, as it is translated here. This is the factor, this is the cause for being able to see things in accordance with the reality. And what this means is that the path of practice should really be aiming at achieving that samadhi, achieving that stillness of the mind, because only then is it possible to see things in accordance with the reality. Without that samadhi, it is impossible to see things as they actually are. Right? A very important thing that I think often is perhaps not appreciated enough on the Buddhist path, that samadhi is foundational for being able to get to that insight. So what then is the whole purpose? What is this path all about then? Does it mean that there is no insight before that? Not really, but what it means is that the insight before you get to samadhi should be the type of insight that leads you towards samadhi. Right? And what kind of insight is that? It is basically an understanding of your own mind, an understanding in particular of those things that hinder you from achieving samadhi. This is the most important thing. What are the things that hinder you in achieving samadhi? The defilements, the hindrances, the nivarana, that's why they call hindrances, right? The sensual desire, the ill will, the sloth and torpor, the restlessness and the doubt. This is essentially what hinders you from attaining samadhi. So any insight in the early parts of the path should be focused on those things that stop you from getting towards this goal. So it should be about understanding the hindrances in the mind. And it's interesting, when you read the Satipatthana Sutta, that's exactly what you see in the Satipatthana Sutta. There's this focus there, very heavy focus on understanding the defilements and understanding the obstructions to samadhi. So this is an important part of this path as well, to understand those hindrances. And as we do that, we get to samadhi, and eventually we may even be able to see things in accordance with reality. So those are some of the main themes of this simple little sutta. Right, it seems so repetitive, it seems so boring, you think, oh, really boring, but actually, it is so incredibly meaningful, right, when you dive into this and you really delve into the details. Wow, it is such a powerful little sutta. So now I want to just have a look at each of the individual factors here, just very briefly, and go through this so that you get a little bit more understanding of what is going on. So you start off with being moral, right, or having the right habits in life and all the right behavior. This is the very first step. And based on that, it is always based on sila, based on habits, that meditation happens. Meditation comes from that. And so the next factor, once you have the virtue and the habits in place, is you have non-regret. You don't think, whoa, I did these bad things, I didn't do the good things or whatever. You have no regret as a consequence. And that non-regret is not just a matter of kind of feeling kind of reproaching yourself or whatever. Non-regret is a subtle thing here. It's subtle in the sense that it just darkens the mind a little bit, right? You don't feel so good about yourself, or you don't have the happiness you should have because you have done something which wasn't quite nice. And sometimes you can feel that in your meditation. Your meditation doesn't become so bright, right? If you've done something bad just recently, your meditation doesn't brighten up so much. It's like there's a shadow in your mind, something which holds you back from being able to meditate properly. And that is what is meant by non-regret here. The mind is a natural thing. It's not something that you can always do away with 100%. It has to be there to some degree here. Why is that? Why is it that we can't just forgive these things 100%? A lot of Buddhist teachings is about forgiving ourselves, right? Okay, we did something bad. You forgive whatever you did. And of course, that is a very important part of the Buddhist teachings, to be able to forgive ourselves. But the problem is that forgiveness, yes, it is powerful, it's useful, but it can only go so far. And the reason it can only go so far is because of this feeling of the self that we have inside of us, right? When you do something, whether it's good or whether it's bad, you have to take responsibility to at least some extent. Because the feeling of self inside of us says, I did this, right? I chose to do this. And of course, if you really did this, if you really chose to do it, you will always feel some degree of responsibility. So yes, you can forgive yourself maybe 90%, maybe 95%, but there will be a little residue left in there which kind of darkens the mind down. And that is this residue of the sense of self inside of you which says, I am responsible for this. And for this reason, although forgiveness is important, it is not enough. You also have to have the virtuous behavior. If you don't, you will feel regret as a consequence. It is just a completely natural consequence, one thing leading to the next one. But if you are able to live that virtuous life, if you're able to get into the right habits, then you have no regret, avipatisari, and because of that no regret, there is nothing inside your mind which blocks you from feeling a sense of joy. Right? And that joy that you feel, I'm sure almost all of you here occasionally experience this kind of joy. It's the kind of joy of just feeling happy about life, right? Kind of skipping around, feeling light, feeling easy, feeling that you are living a good life. And you feel kind of glad, it's a sense of gladness inside of you because you are living in the right way. It's a kind of light feeling, a feeling of kind of ease and feeling of contentment and happiness with yourself. The sort of things that we most people feel occasionally. And the Pali word for this is pamuja. Pamuja is what is lies behind this. And this is really the first stage in the meditation practice, right? When things start to work in the right way. Things feel light. Things feel easy. You feel good about yourself. Things are kind of heading in the right direction. The sense of joy inside of you. Yes, I'm living a good life, right? I'm doing the right thing here. Your mind is in the right space. This is when meditation really becomes possible. And then, as you then continue your meditation practice, whether you are just sitting there enjoying the peace, whether you are watching the breath, whether you're doing the Brahma Viharas, whether you are whatever watching your mind or whatever it is that you are doing, there's all these different things that we can do. And as you do that, that sense of gladness, it becomes deeper, right? And the next stage here is the piti. And the piti is a more powerful sense of happiness inside of you. And very often it is felt physically, you can feel it physically in the body. It's like this kind of beautiful currents almost running through the body in a physical sense. Sometimes some of the strange perceptions you may have in meditation, if you are feeling peaceful and you're feeling good, some of those strange perceptions can be related to that experience of piti, of rapture inside of you. These currents, right? These kind of strange things happening, but beautiful things, right? At this point, the meditation is starting to feel very nice and very beautiful. There is a long description of the various types of piti. This is found in the Visuddhimagga, which can perhaps be useful, but there's different ways this can manifest, but it doesn't matter so much. Usually you will know when it's there because it feels like a sense of something physical going on in the body. And as you do that, as you kind of keep on focusing on the breath or whatever it is, and that rapture, that kind of relatively core sense of happiness, it starts to die down. And then you're moving towards tranquility. And this tranquility is a kind of stage when the body becomes incredibly peaceful, right? This is why it's called tranquility here. And it's when you start, you sit there, and it's almost like you feel like you never want to get up again. This is what it feels like. It feels like, wow, everything is so incredibly tranquil. It is so beautiful. The body feels so solid. There's no restlessness there anymore. There's nowhere you want to go. And you have this feeling, oh, I could sit like this until eternity, right? There's no need to do anything else. Unfortunately, it's not going to last until eternity. It is only going to last a certain while. Maybe fortunately, actually, it wouldn't be, probably after a while you get fed up as well if you have to sit there for eternity. Eternity is quite long, remember that. It is a very long amount of time. The point is that eventually the conditions will be such that you can't sustain that tranquility anyway. But it feels like, wow, I could do this forever. And that's when you know you're moving towards tranquility. At this point, it becomes very nice, right? At this point, you start to understand the power of meditation, because actually there's nothing else in the whole world that you would like to do except for sitting right here. And then, this is only the beginning, right? This is kind of the amazing thing with this path. It is so profound. And then from that, you get an even more profound sense of happiness. That tranquility itself is a deep sense of happiness. And then an even more deep sense of happiness comes from that. And this is where it is almost impossible to be distracted anymore in your meditation practice, because the happiness is so profound. It's so easy to stay with whatever you are staying with. It is at this point that you get things like the samadhi nimittas and all these kind of things arising here. And it is this happiness and this powerful experience at this point that draws the mind in, makes the mind still. It makes the one-pointedness possible. The samadhi becomes possible because it's easy, because you don't want to go anywhere else. It's very easy to be one-pointed and for the mind not to be distracted at this point. Right? And this is how samadhi happens. And this is where you have the samadhi prior to the jhanas, and eventually you have the jhanas themselves, which are all part of the samadhi experience. So these are some of the things that you can look forward to, hopefully. And if it doesn't happen all on this retreat, then there will be other retreats in the future. But if you practice in the right way, this is how gradually these things will come about as a consequence. If it doesn't come about, you have to ask yourself why, because there is a reason for that. And the reason for that is always, go back to the beginning, it is found in your behavior, your habits. And that is where the causes for these things are to be found. So that is the sequence there for you. It's wonderful, isn't it? It's absolutely, it is marvelous that there are such teachings in the world that can give us this kind of profound experience of ourselves and experience in general. Maybe one last thing about this sequence, which is important as interesting as well. This sequence, just to give you some idea of how it connects with dependent origination, because that is what we're going to have a look at during this retreat. And dependent origination, you will probably remember, many of you, it starts off with ignorance, right, avidya. It goes through the 12 links and it ends up with dukkha, with suffering at the end. Right? And then there are certain suttas where it continues after suffering here. And after dukkha, the next stage, it says, dukkha gives rise to faith. So why does dukkha give rise to faith? And the reason is because if you understand that there is a problem in life, this is what the Buddha said, right? He said, oh, there's a problem here. I need to find a solution to this problem. And that is why the Buddha went forth and became a monk as a consequence of that. And the same thing for us. If we understand that there is a problem, there is something to be solved, then we start to look for a solution. And when you start to look for a solution, you may come across some teachings that kind of guide you in the right way. And of course, from a Buddhist point of view, we would say the Buddhist teachings probably most likely, right? So you come across these teachings, and then faith arises, because these teachings are telling you exactly what the problem is, and you can recognize the problem, and they show you a way out, a solution to what is going on. So faith arises, and from that faith, when you finally see a solution, of course you feel a sense of joy, right? And that joy is exactly the same joy that we're talking about here on this particular sequence here. It is the pamuja. It is the same joy that arises from non-regret. So joy can arise from not having any regrets, from feeling good about yourself, but joy can also arise from faith, right? Really understanding that you have discovered wow, you have discovered gold, you have discovered diamonds, you have discovered everything that there is. You have discovered some of the most profound things that can ever be known to humanity when you come across these teachings. Wow, this is just so profound and so beautiful. And that faith, of course, when you see that, that confidence in these teachings gives rise to joy when you see it in the right way. Right? And then from that joy comes this whole sequence again. So dependent arising kind of fits in with the sequence. You start off with depending arising, the dependent arising of dukkha, which is what Paticca-samuppada is about. And from the dependent arising of dukkha, you get the dependent liberation, because you understand dukkha, and then you move away from it as a consequence. There's a seamless kind of connection here between the two, these two causal sequences, if you like. Okay, so I would recommend you to maybe reflect a little bit on that sutta, and because I think it is very powerful and it gives you a very clear idea of the Buddhist path and how this path ideally should be experienced. If you don't get any of these, you know, beautiful states on this retreat, please don't despair. This is not about some kind of materialist Buddhism where we are supposed to, if you don't get them, then you are no good or anything like that. It's not about that at all. It is just to give you some inspiration, to show you, wow, what is available there, and then to help you to find the causes if it doesn't happen. It's all just meant to be a support. It's not meant to be something to beat you up with, anything like that. Use it only as a support. Then it is used in the right way. Okay. Then I would just like to do one quick sutta, the next one here, which is called the Singsapa Grove. And this is just, again, to give you a little bit of background for dependent origination, so that we can approach this teaching in the right way. And once more, I'm going to just read it out, and then I will do some comments. Maybe I'll see what happens as I read it out. So, this is called the Singsapa Grove. This sutta is found in the Sangyutta Nikaya, in the Satcha Sangyutta, the Sangyutta on the truths. Satcha means truth. Four Noble Truths is the Chattaro Satcha, the Four Truths. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in the Singsapa Grove. Then the Blessed One took up a few Singsapa leaves in his hand and addressed the monks thus: "What do you think, monks? Which is more numerous, these few leaves that I have taken up in my hand, or those in the grove overhead?" "Venerable sir, the leaves that the Blessed One has taken up in his hands are few, but those in the grove overhead are numerous." "So too, monks, the things I have directly known but have not taught you are numerous, while the things I have taught you are few. And why, monks, have I not taught you those many things? Because they are unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, and they do not lead to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana. Therefore, I have not taught them." So I'll stop there. So here you have one of these cases where the Buddha kind of does something very obvious, right? He takes a few leaves in his hand and he asks kind of the very obvious question, which leaves are more, and the monks dutifully say, "Oh, the ones in your hand are few," etc. And of course, the whole point here is that the Buddha wants to make a point about this. And this is what this is all about. So maybe first of all, one of the things I should say that almost all the suttas are addressed to the bhikkhus, right? Bhikkhus means monks, quite literally. It means someone who looks a bit like this one over here. Why is it that all the suttas are addressed to the monks? Does it mean that everybody else is left out? What is going on here? And sometimes you will find that there are suttas addressed to the nuns, bhikkhunis, not many at all, but occasionally there are, or they are addressed to the monks and the nuns. Sometimes there are suttas that are addressed to the lay people, but why is it that the suttas are almost always addressed to the monks? And the reason, one of the main reasons, is that at the time of the Buddha, you always addressed, when you gave a discourse, a teaching, you always addressed it to those people who were considered the most senior in the assembly. So even if the assembly had lots of bhikkhunis, lots of lay people sitting there, the Buddha would still speak to the monks. This is just the way, this was just the custom at the time. There is a sutta where the Buddha talks to three monks, right? When he talks to the three monks, he is addressing the whole discourse to the most senior monk there. The most senior monk was called Anuruddha, and he calls the three monks Anuruddhas in the plural, right? So these other ones, they become like little Anuruddhas, and they're kind of part of the same group. And this was a very common way in those days to address people. You addressed it to the most senior people. So remember that, because it means that these things are by no means exclusive. It is just one of those conventions at the time. And also, it is just a memory technique. It's more easy to memorize the suttas if you always have the same people that is being addressed to. It is just that's another reason for this. Anyway, just so that you don't feel left out, right? It's important to feel included, otherwise you kind of lose some of its meaning here. So he says that, Buddha says here that I have only taught you a few things. The things that I actually know are far more numerous, right? Why have I not taught them? Well, because they're not really beneficial. They don't really get you anywhere. And I think this is one of those, it's actually a very important statement about here, we're seeing here, because it shows us what is important in life, what are the things that we need to focus on, what are the things that we perhaps shouldn't focus on so much. There's a lot of implications in this. And in one way, what the Buddha is saying, all of these other things that I have understood, well, maybe he has understood things about the nature of the world, right, the nature of the mind, the nature of the universe, or whatever. He has understood these things because he has understood the laws that underpin these things. But they don't really, they're just facts, right? They're just facts about the world. The world works in this way. You don't need all those facts. You don't need to clog up your mind with all this kind of useless information. There is a problem at hand. There is a problem of suffering. We want to move away from that. We don't have time to spend all this time investigating philosophy, investigating science, understanding things, just filling ourselves up with facts. There is no time for that. Is it difficult enough to understand the Buddhist teachings as they are, and even more difficult to actually practice them properly? So this is what the Buddha is saying here. Let's focus on what really matters. Let's not get sidetracked into all these kind of discussions that are not really useful. Maybe interesting, and this is part of the problem. It often is really interesting, and that's why we tend to get sidetracked. So this is important for, I wanted to say this as a background to this particular topic I'm going to talk about. Dependent origination. Dependent origination can lead to all kinds of discussions, right? Endless discussions about what it really means and all these kind of things. But that is not really the point. The point of any teaching of the Buddha is really to remind ourselves how to practice, what we need to do to take a practical approach to these things, not a theoretical and intellectual approach, which will only lead to more thinking and never really get us anywhere. So please keep that in mind as we do look at dependent origination, so that we don't kind of use it in the wrong way, so to speak. Now, another important aspect of this, and this is what the Buddha is saying here, it is that the practical things that matter, all the philosophical things are really secondary at best, and sometimes they can be left out completely. And this has also another very important side effect, and that is to remember that in the Buddhist teachings, there's a lot of focus on the Abhidhamma around the world. People will read the Abhidhamma, they love the Abhidhamma, and they think the Abhidhamma is, has a lot of useful information, all these kind of things. But really, the Abhidhamma, what is the Abhidhamma? The Abhidhamma really is a work of philosophy. That's what it is. It is a philosophy. It's about dividing the world up into these minute parts. It's about understanding how all these parts are interlinked, right? But understanding time, how time is divided up into these minute things. It is really a work of philosophy here. It's a bit like science. Science is is often called natural philosophy. That was the name that was used for science in the 19th century in the UK. And probably in Australia and the whole English-speaking world, it's called a natural science. And in the same way, the Abhidhamma really is a kind of natural philosophy, rather. The Abhidhamma, too, is a kind of philosophy. It's a mixture of experience and perhaps speculation about how the world really works. And the point here is not whether the Abhidhamma is right or wrong. That's kind of irrelevant. The point is that it is philosophy here. And what the Buddha is saying here is that we are looking at all those trees overhead, all the trees that are on the leaves, instead of focusing on the leaves in the Buddha's hand. The leaves in the Buddha's hand are found in the suttas. They're not found in the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma is a later work, right? And because of that, we're focusing in the wrong place. And we need to go back to those leaves in the Buddha's hands, rather than focusing on all these other things. And it is enough, you know, you start reading the suttas, you start to realize there's enough in the suttas to nourish your practice for a long, long time. It is very few people who have a really full understanding of the suttas. In fact, of course, you really need to be an Arya to fully understand these things. But even understanding them in a more basic way is actually takes a lot of interest and a lot of contemplation sometimes to understand these things properly here. So what the Buddha is saying here, focus on the teachings I have given. Right? In those days, at the time of the Buddha, lot of people gained arahantship, right? Monks and nuns, lots of lay people had very profound meditation. And today, when we're studying the Abhidhamma, people are getting much less results. So maybe that's one of the reasons, right? People are studying too much of these side issues rather than focusing on the core teachings of the Buddha. So this is one of those implications of what the Buddha is saying here. Let's forget about the philosophy. It doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. It really is irrelevant. And we are kind of moving away from the essence of what this life is about. So what is that essence? And that essence, as it says here, are those things that all of these things, it shouldn't, well, the problem with the philosophy is that it is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. It does not lead to all of these things, right? It's unbeneficial. In other words, it doesn't take you forward on the path. It doesn't move you towards all these qualities that we are supposed to develop. It is irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. It is not really part of those things that allow the spiritual life to move forward. It does not lead to revulsion. The Pali word here is nibbida. And nibbida just means this turning away from those things in the world that are suffering. When you see that something is suffering, you are naturally repelled. You are naturally averse. You want to move away from those things. It's a bit like when you decide to take on the five precepts, you decide to live a virtuous life. You have a slight repulsion, right, to doing what is wrong. The idea of stealing repels you. You feel slightly revolted by the idea of even doing that. And the idea of killing or of harming somebody or someone, again, it feels almost revolting inside. And this is what is meant here. This nibbida, the mind turns away from those things. And that is what is meant. Revulsion is a very strong word, but it gives you some idea of what is going on there. Dispassion, right? Dispassion. You become dispassionate towards these things. You lose your interest. You're moving away. Craving is starting to fall down, fall away. Cessation. This craving comes to an end, right? And then to peace, upasama, the calming of the mind, direct knowledge. Abhinya, we could translate as insight, if you like, rather than direct knowledge. To sambodhi, enlightenment or awakening, which I think is a preferable translation. And then nibbana, which really means like extinguishment in Pali. What is it that we are extinguishing? We are extinguishing all those negative things in the mind, all those things that give rise to suffering, all the defilements, the greed, hatred and delusion. That is what we are extinguishing. And Nibbana literally is that state where all of those things are extinguished. Right? So if you would like insight, if you would like peace, if you would like awakening, if you would like to extinguish all those suffering states inside of you, if you think this is a good idea, then focus on the teachings of the Buddha. Focus on those beautiful practical discourses that will lead you in the right way. And those leaves that the Buddha held in his hands, they are the ones that matter, not all those other leaves that the Buddha or the Abhidhamma or modern science or whatever is talking about. That is kind of side issues. And of course, the problem with those side issues, they can be so interesting, right? So incredibly exciting to discuss these things in detail. And that is part of the problem. That is why it often leads astray. So what is the opposite? And what, bhikkhus, have I taught? I have taught this is suffering. I have taught this is the origin of suffering. I have taught this is the cessation of suffering. I have taught this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And why, bhikkhus, have I taught this? Because this is beneficial. It is relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. It leads to repulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to insight, to awakening, and to extinguishment. Therefore, I have taught this. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand, or you should practice to understand, this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So this is what the Buddha has taught, right? These, of course, are the four noble truths. And all the rest of the Dhamma, all the teachings, all the four Nikayas, all the suttas, everything we have from the Buddha is included in these four noble truths. And as I was saying before, please keep in mind that when the Buddha says, this is suffering, remember it also means the other side of the coin, right? When you have taught this is suffering, he has also taught this is the lack of happiness. When he has taught this is the origin of suffering, he has also taught this is the origin of the lack of happiness. When he has taught the cessation of suffering, he has taught happiness. That's what cessation of suffering is. And when he has taught the path leading to the cessation of suffering, he has taught the path leading to happiness. So remember that it has these two sides to it. And that kind of, sometimes that sort of resonates better with people. Because teaching, otherwise the Four Noble Truths, are often just too profound for us to really be able to grasp what is going on. And when we understand these things, and I'm going to go through the Four Noble Truths in a fair bit of detail later on, because they're actually very interesting, and it's good to have, obviously, some understanding of this, because this is the basic Buddhist teachings, the basic right view. This stands at the beginning of dependent origination, and this is why it is so important as well. The beginning of dependent origination is avidya. It is precisely the lack of understanding of these things. So if we can approach these things a little bit, get a more feel for what they mean, then already we are undermining the avidya at the beginning of dependent arising. And when you do that, then all these wonderful consequences come as a consequence, right? All these beautiful things. This is what is beneficial. This is what is relevant to the fundamentals of the holy life. This is what leads to that repulsion. Remember, what you are being repelled from is suffering itself. That is all you're being repelled from. Nothing else. To dispassion. To dispassion from what? Dispassion from suffering. A cessation, the cessation of suffering, or the cessation of the craving for suffering. What we are really craving in this world is suffering. To peace, right? The movement away from suffering, to insight, to understanding of suffering, to awakening, understanding where happiness and suffering truly lie, and finally to the extinguishment of all that suffering as a consequence. So very powerful, these Four Noble Truths. That is what we should be focusing on. So please keep that in mind. When we go through this dependent arising, it is not for the purpose of proliferating intellectually. It is for a very practical purpose, to help us on this wonderful, amazing, powerful Buddhist path of Buddhist meditation and Buddhist practice in general. Okay, so that is 1 hour disappeared. And so we will continue on the suttas again later on. So 3 o'clock this afternoon, we will continue on these things. In the meantime, just keep on enjoying yourself. Have a nice meal, and we'll see you again at 3 o'clock.